Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Crimes committed almost a century and a half ago usually have little interest among today's population unless the crime remains unsolved. Just such a crime is considered one of the most heinous in our nation's history and was committed in our own backyard. In the area around Belleville and Millstadt, Illinois, you can still get a conversation going about the 1874 axe murders of Saxtown. Saxtown was a rural German immigrant community in which five members of a farm family were brutally murdered. Post-Dispatch reporter Nicholas Pistor, who grew up in the area more than a century later, has heard talk of the crime all of his life and has taken the conversation one step further in his new book, The Axe Murders of Saxtown, the unsolved crime that terrorized a town and shocked the nation. That shock, we are told, was rivaled then only by the assassination of Abraham Lincoln a decade earlier. Nick Pistor joins me in studio. Nick, nice to have you with us. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's a fun read, particularly for people around here, I'm sure, because there's that great, great, great local connection.
Yeah, and it's an exciting story. Yeah.
But, you know, 140 years is a long time ago, and putting together the pieces had to be difficult. How did you go about that 140 years later?
It was quite a process. I had heard about the stories, particularly there are a lot of ghost stories that sort of tantalize a lot of younger people. And so that sort of went away as I was at college. And then I had a professor named Father Francis Cleary, who was a well-known historian of the famous exorcism case. And I had talked to him once in passing, and he had mentioned that this case existed because I had told him where I was from, and he had remembered reading something about it. And that spurred me to go back and start looking at some of the original newspaper articles. I went to St. Pius Library, actually, at SLU, and started finding some of the original newspaper articles from the St. Louis Dispatch. Most newspapers that are out of business now, some like the Post and the Dispatch merge. And so I started piecing that together, and it just sort of stayed there for a while until I became a reporter at the Post Dispatch. And I decided I was going to write a book about it, and it became a much bigger process than I expected, mainly because it happened 140 years ago and there were so many complications. Many of the really good newspaper articles were actually written in German. And I remember going up to the Abraham Lincoln Library in Springfield, Illinois, because they had the largest cache of those documents there. I remember being so excited to find them. And once I put them on the screen, I realized I didn't even know what I was looking for because I don't speak a word of German. So I was able to find as many of them as I could, and I printed them off, and I sent them away to a woman in California who was native of Germany who translated them for me. Her name's Anne Rose Romer, and she did a fantastic job. And she got so interested in this case, and we'll talk about the facts of it in a little bit, but she got so interested in the case that she was writing notes in the margin and trying to, you know, help me point me in the direction of who she thought did it and that sort of stuff. But those were the main complications. But there was another big one. And it, for a while, I thought I would never be able to write the book is because the original case file, the grand jury investigative reports, was stolen sometime in the 1890s. And that really left me without a lot of material. But through a lot of work, particularly getting the translations, putting together the history of who these people were, the ancestry work that I had to do, that helped bring the story to life and helped me give enough that it could be a book.
Yeah, in reading the book and particularly in starting it, I was struck by how similar this case is and was in 1874 to the In Cold Blood case of Truman Capote, you wrote about, mm-hmm. well over a century later. Rural farm family in Kansas murdered in their beds at night by these passersby. There's a lot of similarities there.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that really, I think, excites people about the drama of the crime. When in that case, this farm family in the middle of nowhere turns up, you know, they were shot. But in this case, that's what happened here. An entire family of five was found brutally murdered by an axe by a neighboring farmer. He actually walked to their cabin. He noticed that outside of the house that things weren't right. The cows hadn't been milked. Various other signs of no life. There was no smoke coming from their chimney. He opened the door to their house. It was unlocked. And he walked in and found a brutal, terrible scene.
Well, you know, this story really got some legs throughout the entire country at the time. The major newspapers across the country were reporting it. I wonder why. Was it just that sensational? Was nothing else going on? You know, if we just had a civil war, were people looking for other things to talk about?
Yeah, and people were not desensitized to violence. They certainly it was part of life. And if you look at the headlines back then, it was an entirely different country that we lived in. This crime really struck home to people, I think, because of the unsolved nature of it. From almost the beginning, there was no idea of suspects. But the other thing is that there were two children who were murdered, and one was so badly murdered that they couldn't identify his face. So I think the gruesome nature of it and you know, the sensationalism of some of the newspapers helped feed it of some headlines screamed demonism or that, that the person who did this was so out of control because it wasn't just a desire to kill. It was a desire to mutilate these people. And that factored into some of the investigation of the case.
But there had been some other cases, as you point out in the book, that were fairly sensational in their own way. I'm thinking of the Bender case, for instance.
Right.
You can tell folks what that was about.
Yeah, that was sort of the preamble. Basically, a year before the axe murders of Saxtown, this family who lived out in Kansas, they were called the Bloody Benders is what they're known as now. And it was another German immigrant family, actually, but they were the ones doing the killing. They had an inn, and they lived out there, and people who would pass by their inn on the trail out west would have supper, and the young girl would hit them over the head with a sledgehammer or something while they were eating, and then they would drop them through a trap door and discard the bodies, and they'd steal from them and do all that. They actually, right before they got discovered, they got out of town. And right when the Saxtown murders occurred, reports of this family were all over the country, many in Illinois, that people were spotting them. And one of the early theories was maybe this family had somehow stumbled into this farm community and killed this family. But that went away. That was pretty much discounted.
All of this stuff was going on before violence on television and before violent video games. Imagine that.
Yes, it was an entirely different time. And really, as far as media, newspapers was really the only way people learned about these things, and perhaps maybe that's why they covered it a little bit more. It was really a shocking tale.
One of the difficulties, as I mentioned to you before we went on the air, about doing an interview like this about a book is you don't want to give away everything. Mm-hmm. But the essence of this is given away by the fact we know five people were murdered and we know it's an unsolved crime. So that's the basic story. But I am interested in the time and what mm-hmm. that community was like, because that plays a big part in your book and it's fascinating in and of itself. Give us a thumbnail description of what life over there near Millstatt and Belleville was like in 1874.
Well, it was entirely different than what we know of today. This family came over from Germany, as did most of the other people out living in rural St. Clair County and in a lot of other parts of St. Louis. They came over, and the reason why they came over was like most of the others is that the time was so tough in Germany. They weren't allowed to own land if you're a nobody, and so they had this desire to come here. And through the guise of the family that was murdered, the elder man, Mr. Stelzenried, came over here because he felt that something bad was going to happen to him in Germany. His house had burned down. He rebuilt it, and then lightning struck it and burned it down again. He had lost four of his five children. He finally said, "I'd had enough," and he came over here. He had no success in Germany, but it was sort of this like Book of Job type struggle. Every bad thing was happening to him, and he felt something bad was going to happen to him again. And so he came over here to the United States, which at the time was just after the Civil War. It was plunged into a deep recession, our first depression. It was called the Long Depression, which not a lot of people know about, but it became a factor in this crime. And they came to this farm and they started their own farm, and it was a tough life. People who lived out there really had to make a go of it as best as they could. If you lost all your teeth, you lost all your teeth. Their hands were often mangled by the work that they had to do on the farm. The women were what they call bent from going to the creek to bring up buckets of water. And one of the things that I describe in the book, and there's another woman who's actually murdered before this, and she's a bride. And I tried to describe what the outlook was like for a woman at this time and on a farm, and it wasn't good. You basically had, you know, a brief period of after you're married, and then you're expected to have children. But women weren't only expected to have children. They were expected to do all sorts of manual labor on the farm. They were expected to go out and help in the field. They were expected to cook. They were expected to clean. They were expected to do all these things. So everyone just – everyone looks so much older than what we think of today. You know, people aged so quickly, and, you know, many were missing fingers. They were missing teeth. You know, so you try to think about that today, and it's almost unheard of.
They tended to congregate together. That's understandable. Immigrants have always done that so they can communicate with each other and understand each other. But that was certainly the case here.
Yeah, they basically built their own German community out in this place called Saxtown and Millstadt and Belleville, but particularly out in the rural parts. They basically spoke German all the time. English was unheard of. And that's really why a lot of the German language newspapers covered this heavily, and they really had a lot of details. A lot of the English papers didn't.
You know, aside from the fact that they were all speaking the same language, was it otherwise a close-knit community?
Yeah, they all knew each other, and that was what made this crime even more horrific to them. Not only did they know this family very well, but the person who did it most likely was living amongst them, and it set off this horrible suspicion amongst everyone, thinking, well, somebody with an axe is out here, and he might come and try to kill me, and that went on for decades. There was always fear that someone was on the prowl.
And there was never any certainty that it was only one person.
No. And in fact, early on, the sheriff arrived at the scene and thought it was one person. And most of the other investigators quickly disagreed with him and said they thought it was more than one. And that really is even worse to someone when you're thinking, you know, not only is one person crazy enough to walk into somebody's house and chop up their bodies with an axe, but two people may have been involved. It's horrible.
Horrible indeed. I want to pick up on the investigation and the investigation process with Nick Pister, who is our guest in studio today. His book, a new book, which is doing very well, I'm happy to be able to report, The Axe Murders of Saxtown, the unsolved crime that terrorized a town and shocked the nation. Saxtown was a German immigrant community near Millstadt and Belleville. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Nick in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Nick Pister, the author of The Axe Murders of Saxtown. If you recognize the name, it's because you've seen his byline in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's been a reporter there for some years. How long now, Nick?
10 years.
10 years already. Wow. And you're only 32 years old. Got an early start. But before we continue that conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and Beacon Newsroom is following today. A new report finds that the poverty rate in Missouri is increasing. The group Missourians to End Poverty Coalition says the rate has risen more than 3% since 2008. Further, more than 900,000 state residents are living in poverty. Missouri candidates face a deadline tonight to file quarterly campaign finance reports. The reports will reveal how much money they have on hand heading into an election year. In the case of gubernatorial and attorney general candidates, the report should reveal how much they have already amassed for a 2016 election run. And this month's Midwest snowstorm has boosted water levels on the Mississippi River. The river was about 3 feet below normal last week, but melting snow has increased the level to slightly above normal levels, and that's making things easier for shippers. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to Nick Pister, the book The Axe Murders of Saxtown, the unsolved crime that terrorized a town and shocked the nation. It is a town no more.
No, and it really wasn't then. It was just a hamlet. It was basically a conglomeration of farms. It was unincorporated St. Clair County, and you know, today you can go out there, and actually many of the same families, their last names, they still own property out there that were involved in the time of 1870s.
And there's a Saxtown Road, for
there's
instance.
There's a Saxtown Road,
still
and
some connections.
There's a lot of connections like that. There's an old Saxtown school that was out there and things like that.
Well, one of the names that comes up throughout the book is the name Eckert. Mm-hmm. That's certainly still well known out there. Are the Eckerts of Orchard fame related to those Eckerts?
Everyone asks me about that, and that is not – they are not – at least closely related to the Eckerts that were involved in this case. The nearest neighbor to the Stelzreed family had the last name Eckert, and he was actually an administrator of the estate after they died. And his son was arrested for the crime, as were seven other people. And the Eckert, actually, the interesting part of it, and Eckert actually owns the property today where the Stilson Reed house and barn and farm stand.
And the only thing left is of the original property is the barn.
Correct.
Right. Another name that pops up is Freivogel, the name of a cemetery there. We'll have to check with Margie and Bill Freivogel.
Yes.
Where we're related to here to find out if there's any association there.
Yes, and the Freivogels were actually some of the original settlers of the area, and the cemetery there where the bodies are buried in actual unmarked graves is Freivogel Cemetery. Mm. There is a monument to the murdered family in Belleville's Walnut Hill Cemetery, but it's a monument that marks no grave. There are no bodies there.
But there was a movement afoot at one time to move the bodies from Freivogel Cemetery to the other one.
Yes, the book actually begins with the prologue, which is sort of a dramatic beginning of the Walnut Hill Cemetery undertaker coming to get these bodies and dig them up from Freivogel Cemetery in Saxtown and bring them 8 miles to Belleville. But the Saxtown farmers find out that he's on his way, and they go to the cemetery, and they're there. They're with their guns and pitchforks, and they're ready to do anything to stop him. And he turned around, and he left, and he came back once more, but he never got those bodies. They're still there in unmarked graves.
Let's get back to the time and place of all of this going on. I wanted to talk about the investigation because the times were a little bit different then. The police of the day, the sheriffs of the day, if you will, the law enforcement people of the day had none of the kind of resources that we think of today when we think of investigating a crime. The first thing that occurred to me, as you point out in the book, is after the crimes were discovered, dozens, scores, perhaps even hundreds of people ultimately made their way to the crime scene, which speaks and screams contamination
yes,
of the crime
yes.
scene. Pick it up from that point.
Yeah. So after the bodies are discovered, the sheriff is so far away. The sheriff, St. Clair County Sheriff, is actually in Belleville, and somebody is dispatched to go get him. But meanwhile, people are hearing through word of mouth as fast as a horse can gallop or as fast as a person can run that this family has been murdered on this farm. So they're all rushing to the scene. And by the time the sheriff ever arrives, upwards of 100 to 200 people are actually already on the lawn of the cemetery. People are actually walking in and out
of the house.
Or of the house, I'm sorry. And there, people are actually walking in and out of the house to, you know, have looked at these bodies. And so that really brings this to life in a way because it's 1874. It is really right on the end of a time period because right after 1874, you begin to see a lot of the technological innovations that have changed police work but also changed society. It's 2 years removed from the invention of the telephone. It's before fingerprinting was used. It's before any idea of forensic science or even really before crime scene photography. So none of those things existed then. So the main police techniques that a cop would use would be a thing called sweating, which is basically bringing a suspect into the police station and, you know, putting him under intense questioning, hoping that they'll confess. A confession was really what they wanted. That's all they wanted, and that was their idea of police work.
The technique of sweating is not absent today. We still see, certainly in the older movies, the bright light put on a suspect as he or she is being questioned.
Yes, yes. And that was a term that was used, really started to be used back then.
The sheriff in this particular case, as you indicated, had to come from Belleville. How long a trip was that? I mean, we know in terms of miles, but he had to come by horseback. How long would it take?
It took him, in the book, it's about 2 hours for him to arrive,
Yeah, it's considerable. But he wasn't really a trained law enforcement officer.
No, he was a politician. And that really became a factor in this because he was more concerned about trying to solve the case or trying to announce that the case had been solved to quell everyone's fear because people were ready to lynch somebody. They were up in arms and people weren't sleeping. They were guarding their houses and their property. This family was rumored to have been killed over a legacy gold fortune. And the economic times were so tough that somebody they thought had wanted that money and wanted it badly to kill this family. And so that really began sort of this idea that anyone who had any money on their property, and most people did, because banks were so far away that it was hard to store money in them. And so the sheriff really honed in on that, and he was trying to arrest somebody as quickly as possible. He ended up arresting 8 people at different times with different theories as to who and why they did it. He was never able to keep any of them in jail. He was a well-known Democratic politician in the state of Illinois. He actually was a delegate to the famous 1860 convention that in Charleston, South Carolina, that was the precursor to the Civil War. He hated Abraham Lincoln.
We don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves in this and give too much away, but it's too fascinating to dismiss, and that is the fact that the sheriff, Sheriff Hughes, died himself under mysterious circumstances sometime later.
Just as this case reopened, this case was open and shut at different points, but about 10 years after the case had happened, the murders occurred about 10 years later. He was walking in the upper floor of the Belleville St. Clair County Courthouse, and he fell over a railing, although many people suspected that he had been pushed. He was a very strong, steady man, and it seemed unlikely that he would have just fell down to the stone floor. There were no witnesses.
Well, let's get back to the point where he was alive and investigating this case. What did he have to work with? I mean, realistically, given the situation of that day and the lack of the kind of resources we're familiar with, what did he actually have to work with?
Well, the evidence was not great. He was basically working with anyone who saw anyone, and this murder occurred in the dead of night, in the deep, dark dead of night. They believe that the killer most likely was nearby because it was a rainy season. Everything was so wet, and it would be really impossible to get in and get out quickly without really being caught or seen by somebody. So they believe it was a neighbor and somebody who knew this family. And one other reason why they thought somebody knew this family is that the dog that the family just purchased from a neighbor was penned up back outside, but it believed the dog had been seen roaming the property that night, and they believe that the dog knew the killer and allowed the killer to enter because the dog was apparently vicious and would not have allowed anyone into that house unless it knew the person.
That's a pretty strong clue. It occurred to me as I was reading the book because we all know dogs and the way they do react when strangers or people unexpectedly show up.
Yes. And so that was a major factor, as well as there were some bloody tobacco leaves. Tobacco was often used then to draw out blood from a wound or something like that. So bloody tobacco leaves were found nearby some bloody trail from the house. And they were looking at nearby properties. And one of the properties was a brother-in-law who actually owed the Stelson-Reed family a lot of money. And his debt would have been wiped out if the family, entire family, was murdered. And he would have possibly thought he would have inherited some money. And so those bloody tobacco leaves pointed in the direction of his farm, but it also pointed in the direction of everyone else's farm because this is not a linear place. Farms are spread out in a ramshackle sort of way. So that theory was just one of many that pointed it to different suspects.
You know, you talked about he owed money. Another thing that I was struck by in the book is the amount of lending that was going on amongst these people and fairly significant sums. I mean, we're talking hundreds of dollars in that day was an awful lot of money for people to have tucked under the mattress.
Yeah, and the murdered family, their farm was basically landlocked. So one of the best – they really couldn't expand that well. One of the best ways for them to make money was loaning money that they already had out. Mm-hmm. And so – that became a pretty big factor, you know, because it was well known that they had that money at that house. And the United States was in a terrible depression. People wanted money so bad. And that could have been the desire that someone had.
Another part of the story concerns the old man, the patriarch, I guess, of the family, who was believed to have inherited some of this gold from the old country, was seen walking around with his wicker basket around his neck, and they all thought that that's where the gold was.
Yeah, it was obvious a suspicion that he had the gold on him at all times out of fear that someone was going to try to steal it, so he kept it on his person. And that may have been their mistake. They may have been way too public about the money that they had, and that's how it changed this community afterwards. And even if you still go out there today, even the older people, mostly the older people, very careful to say that they have money or even show of any type of money for fear that someone will break into their house and kill them for it.
There is a certain amount of fear today, even so many years after all this happened. If I recall correctly, you even wrote that you were fearful at times growing up because you had heard the story and were afraid.
Yes, it can kind of get into your head because there's this theory that there's a curse, that most of the people who investigated the crime had terrible deaths afterwards or almost immediately after they were investigated. The sheriff obviously died, but a lot of the other investigators, you know, detectives came from all over the country to try to solve this case. One St. Louis detective actually moved out to Saxtown and lived out there for a long time. One detective was known to have crept under a crawl space of a house of a dying suspect of this family to try to think that maybe he would talk in his sleep and admit to killing the Stelson-Reed family. Deathbed confessions were huge back then. You read the newspaper accounts and people would often – there would be filled with somebody confessing to a crime. And it happened with the Bender case too that we just talked about. And this case actually had a confession from someone who committed suicide in Memphis. But it was discounted. People didn't really think that person had done it.
And of course, there was a lot of reward money out there, which attracted a lot of these detectives.
Yes, and that really was another factor that I think may have contributed to this case going unsolved. The sheriff was so focused on offering a lot of money for putting somebody in jail for this crime. It went from $1,000 to $2,000 to $3,000. He tried to get the governor of Illinois to actually increase the reward. The governor, being the first governor of Illinois from Chicago and a former Civil War veteran, a Republican, did not like Sheriff Hughes, the Democrat, was unwilling to provide any money for a reward. But it still was such a large reward that people were coming from all over to try to solve the case. But what happened was they would make any allegation to try to get this reward. So that's how you end up getting all these people arrested and not necessarily a lot of evidence to convict them. And in those years, private detectives, they were really popular then because police work was so new. People, you know, the Saxtown Farmers actually hired private detectives to try to solve this case. St. Louis, the St. Louis police chief, was lobbying for a law to outlaw private detectives at this time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about them. I mean, there were a lot of them that came into play in this particular case, but who were they? How were they trained? And were they any more qualified than Sheriff Hughes, the politician, to investigate?
No. Police techniques were so new. The St. Louis Police Department had actually only existed for a few years in the current form that we know it. This was before Sherlock Holmes. This was before the idea of deduction. This was before even the Jack the Ripper case in the 1880s. It was before Lizzie Borden, before those really late, you know, slaughter-type cases. And it was really before the love affair that America started having with detective work and detective fiction and, you know, true detective stories. And so people were just sort of going about it as they saw fit. A lot of it was trying to get somebody to confess. There was one investigator who actually befriended a suspect. He basically went as in disguise and thought and did not act like he was a detective and tried to get him to confess to the crime. And then he came back and said he did, and he knew so many facts about the crime. And the guy ended up getting arrested.
You mentioned Lizzie Borden. I mean, that case pales in comparison. Lizzie Borden had an axe, gave her father 40 to wax, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her mother 41 or whatever, however
yes.
that goes.
And that crime got so much attention because it was a child, I guess, accused of. And this crime got so much attention at the time and then just fell away. St. Louisans do not know about it. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book is because it deserves to be told because it's an interesting case and it's an interesting time. And it also tells us how far we've come. It tells us so much about ourselves and about our history, about our immigration, about how our current framework of our region really started to crop up. St. Louis was an entirely different city when they came here. This was before Anheuser-Busch was even here in 1876 and before the Post-Dispatch existed in 1878. This was a really different city.
Although you quote the Post-Dispatch at various times, too, but there was the Dispatch, and then there was
right.
a Post, and there was a Globe, and then there was a Daily Globe, and
yes.
they all kind of came together sooner or later, as you've indicated.
It all gets confusing, but one of the major factors is that the St. Louis Daily Globe at the time was really becoming a fantastic newspaper. Their reporters were trained by their editor, Jack McCullough, who just was a Civil War correspondent and started really making reporters go out to the scene and bring the flavor and the color of what happened. He sent reporters to the Saxtown murder scene. They were there. They were allowed by the police to actually walk into the crime scene. Now, I am a reporter. The thought of a detective allowing me to walk into a crime scene with bodies still being there is unheard of today. But these reporters were actually acting like investigators as well. And they were going around interviewing witnesses. They were going around interviewing suspects. They were doing everything that a detective would have done.
And they were part of the problem of contaminating the scene, although it was less relevant, I suppose, because the techniques that we've talked about weren't available. But they were still chomping around in the blood and
yes.
what have you.
And but I'm thankful for them because some of the accounts that they gave really brought to life what that scene looked like, what it smelled like, what the bodies looked like, who was there, what the clock on the wall. The children, actually, their toys were still strewn about the floor that night. They had gone to sleep thinking they were going to wake up.
It's such a horrific visual. I want to ask members of our listening audience to get into this conversation if you'd like to. I'm sure there are many people over there who are familiar with various aspects of the story. Perhaps they'd like to tell us what they've heard and maybe offer some ideas about what might have gone on more than 140 years ago in Saxtown, Illinois. My guest is Nick Pister, who's the author of the book, The Axe Murders of Saxtown. I'm going to take a break just a moment early here, but I want to come back and talk about a more current case that you allude to in the book, sort of similar to this in a way, but it really illustrates how times have changed in the investigative process. Back with Nick Pister in just a moment. If you'd like to come into the conversation, do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Nick Pister, the author of The Axe Murders of Saxtown, the unsolved crime that terrorized a town and shocked the nation. That was a town, a community, if you will, of German immigrants not far from Belleville or Millstadt, Illinois. This crime took place in 1874. Before getting back to your story, this you allude to in the book, and we've talked at some length about the investigative procedures of that day. But you related it in some way to the Coleman case of Columbia, Illinois, in which he was accused of killing his wife and two children. What's your connection there?
Well, I actually covered that case. He was the bodyguard of televangelist Joyce Meyer, and in 2009, his family had turned up strangled in their beds, and he quickly became the suspect and was arrested and later convicted for killing his family. And I was struck at that point about that case and was thinking about it in terms of the Saxtown case 140 years before, basically, just about the differences in police work. In the Coleman case, they were able to track his movements with his cell phone, and they were able to use fingerprints, and even though it wasn't much of a help, but they were able to one of the other major factors was time of death, which did not exist back then, but that became an issue because in the Saxtown case, they wanted to know who died last because that would have been which side of the family would have gotten the family's inheritance because both sides of the family were suspects. And in the Coleman case, they were actually able to determine between a window of time when the family died. So things have just dramatically changed from them. But the thing that the Coleman case didn't have that the Saxtown case does have is that the Coleman case was not a mystery. It was pretty much they knew who the suspect was and he was arrested and acquitted. The Saxtown case remains open. No one will ever be charged with it, and they're certainly all dead, but there's no investigative process that we'll ever find to know who did it.
You have to believe that were modern techniques available then, they probably would have solved this thing in a blink of an eye because there are a lot of people walking around with blood on their boots and other clues that would have helped.
Yes, it would have. I'm almost positive that this case, which is really one of our remaining major mysteries, would have been solved because it would have been much easier. They would have been able to get access to people. They would have been able to have the real tools to solve it. But this type of thing happened, and it was so easy to get away with murder back in the 19th century. One of the things that we often talk about today when we see the headlines and watch the news, and we always say, it's such a terrible time now, and this has never happened before, and things are so bad. People are shooting people and that sort of thing. It was much worse years ago. Nothing about today is new. We have it easy. Back then, people were able to kill each other and basically move to the next town. That can't happen today.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. We have some folks who want to get into this conversation. Nick Pister, let's start with a call from the area itself, from Millstadt. Bob joins us. Go ahead, Bob.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in possession of a book called The Saxtown Murders, written by Wilson Baltz in 1974. I was wondering, Nick, if you were aware of that book.
Yes, I actually reference it in my book. It was basically a pamphlet. It was a newspaper series that they ran in 1974 in the Millstatt Enterprise.
My wife grew up on Bowleyville Road there, just down the road from Saxtown. And I didn't want to get into the murders at all, but I wanted, in the epilogue to that book that I referenced, they talk about Sheriff James Hughes and the fact that he was killed in a stairwell fall in the county courthouse in 1981, and then that Julius Hughes, the deputy, was a victim of a tornado that went through East St. Louis in 1896. I just wanted to mention a couple of those things and see if you were familiar with that book.
That would have been 1881, by the way, at that in which he died.
I am familiar with it. Actually, that was a source, and I actually talked to Wilson before he died. One problem with what he wrote is that he changed the names of a lot of the different people, and it was fictionalized. He fictionalized the murders, but some of those details are true. The sheriff did die, and his son did have a terrible death. He died in the famous tornado at the turn of the century in East St. Louis, and that was one of the ideas of this Saxtown curse, that bad things were going to happen to people who were involved in this case, and those are two of the deaths that are included in that.
Right. Bob, thank you so much for the call. Let's bring in Jonathan calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yes, I've been in St. Louis for over 40 years and never heard of this case, and I was wondering why you think a case like Lizzie Borden would be so world-famous even now, while this case has kind of been forgotten. I mean, I have some theories about Lizzie Borden. Obviously, people find it titillating that a woman was the main suspect, you know, even though she was acquitted. But there are, you know, other strange aspects of the Lizzie Borden case that kind of make it interesting even 100 years later. But why do you think this case in Illinois has been forgotten?
That's a very good question. I get that question a lot. And I think it's a matter of how stories happen and in the times they occur. And sometimes things just fall to the wayside in history. This story made headlines here and nationally. It was on the front page of the New York Times. It was on the front page of papers on the West Coast. It was on the front page of Chicago Daily Tribune. It even made it to Berlin. And then after about 20 years, it became forgotten, and it became forgotten here locally and even to some part in the Illinois area where it occurred. And it's a sad thing, and that's really why I wanted to talk about this case and I wanted to write this book, because it was a story that I wanted to tell, because we have so few mysteries and we have so few new things to talk about. We're still talking about Lizzie Borden, or we're still talking about the JFK assassination, and we're still talking about those things. But this is a real gem from history that we can talk about. And oftentimes, too, in St. Louis, why we may not have heard it, St. Louis is sort of compartmentalized, and a lot of Missourians aren't necessarily as much interested in something that happened in Illinois and vice versa. And that may have been a factor in this as well. Well,
were the people in St. Louis proper in this time, in 1874, were they fascinated by it as were people in other parts of the country?
Yes. The St. Louis papers were dominated with headlines, front page after front page, daily, daily, daily. The St. Louis police chief actually was over in Illinois trying to help the investigators solve the case. People from all over St. Louis were involved, and they were engrossed in what happened.
Everybody was afraid.
Yes, and they were afraid, and they wanted to know who did it, and they wanted it to be solved, because, again, two children were killed, a young lady, is her husband, and an elderly man were killed for no apparent reason other than most likely having money.
And that still is also not known. Let's take another call, again, from the area we're talking about. Lisa in Belleville, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi. I was born and raised in Belleville, and I'm approaching 50 years old, but I never heard of this this crime until about a year ago, some geocacher placed a cache in the area commemorating the experience, which is kind of funny timing. I don't know if he's aware of your work or was inspired by it. But the comment that I wanted to make really addresses the comment that the author made about how people think so many people today are different and more violent. I just finished reading a book called Wisconsin Death Trip, and that was filled with clippings from local and historical records regarding the amount of people that were murdered or committed suicide, which I kind of thought, too, it might be really easy to call something a suicide by the way some of these people died. But it's a fascinating topic, and I'm really glad that you're covering it.
I appreciate it, and I hope you read the book.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. I mean, you can do stories like this from a lot of different places going back a good long while, needless to say. Let's bring in Art calling from South City. Go ahead, Art. You're on the phone.
Thanks for taking the call, John. You know, recollecting the Depression and hearing a lot of personal effects with respect to the banking failures, you know, I sold Globe Democrats 3 cents apiece. I had to sell 3 to make a penny. So I was just wondering what the medium of exchange was and the banking facilities for these people to put their personal wealth, you know, in places that are safe. Did they have such a thing as a penny? How would they deal with people, say, when they were selling eggs or doing something out on the farm road? How would they handle merchandising that type of operation?
Well, they certainly had money, but many, particularly the immigrants and the German immigrants, they really appreciated something like gold. But we got to remember that when this happened, gold is timeless, and there was not as much faith in the American dollar as there is today. This was before America was a big country. America had just fought a civil war. You know, the idea that it was going to be this wonderful, happy, shining place still did not exist. We had still awful strife and turmoil, and many of these people were still fighting the Civil War. People were upset about who won and who lost, and this section of Illinois and in Missouri as well, they were bitterly divided as whether they were Union or Confederates, and those sort of ideas simmered. And the best thing to put your money in was something that was easy and safe, and gold was one of the things. And so if you had something from Germany, that would have been something that you would have been very proud of and you would have been trying to keep.
Let's read this email from Sandra. When I grew up in Waterloo, we'd pass the farm on the drive to Millstatt. One detail my mother always added was that the murder put the family dogs in the house, that the murderer put the family dogs, it was dog actually singular in this particular case, in the house with the victims, and that they were not found for some time. We were told the house was torn down because it was haunted.
And that is a major, not a major factor, but there's a chapter in the book that I devote to the ideas of ghosts out there. I've heard from so many people since the books have just been released for a day. I've heard from people who have said they've seen ghostly images of children out on the highway when they drive out there. The idea that the house is haunted is something certainly that continues on throughout our history. The house was torn down in the 1950s, the original house, and they built a new one over the foundation. And the owner of the house, when he was tearing it down, had said he was just tired of people driving by and doing that sort of thing and pointed to it as that murder house. And so through those years, though, the people who have lived there have said that strange occurrences have occurred to them, particularly around the anniversary of the murders in March, where someone will be knocking on the door and they'll answer it and no one's there. And if you go out there, there's no house or no thing around for miles. It's hard to just sneak up on this house. Other people have said that they've felt the presence of something in that house. And the other thing, we were talking about a dog. Many people have said that they've heard a dog barking in the night, and there's no dog out there. And some people think that maybe that's Monk, the Stelson Reed's dog, from the ghost, from the grave, trying to get somebody to come and solve this case.
So what level of credibility do you give to these ghost stories?
Well, in the book, I try to treat them as what – this is what people say. I don't believe in ghosts necessarily, but I do know a lot of people have had these things happen. And Randy Eckert, who actually owns the property and he rents the house out to people, and his relatives were actually accused of the crime at some point. He's a very credible man. I've talked to him many times, and most of these farmers, the type of people who live out there, are not the type of people who go around claiming to be seeing ghosts and images. So Perhaps sometimes it gets into your head. You know this brutal crime has occurred. No one was ever convicted for it. The state of fear that people were in went on for so long, and that it has been passed on to generation after generation. And maybe you just think something is still there.
Yeah. One of the interesting pictures you painted in the book was of the farm workers. I guess to some degree they were itinerant workers. But this was a different breed, and a number of these people were suspected of the crime because of their demeanor and the way they lived their lives. Give us some sense of what they were like.
They were rough and tumble folks. They came from all over the place. Many of them were Civil War veterans. They had seen awful brutality. They needed work, and so they would basically do anything. One of the things that they needed a lot in St. Clair County in this area was people to dig up tree stumps, because Germans picked their land based on how well the trees grew. Irish people were different. They would pick it on stuff that was well irrigated near water. But the Germans wanted to see how the trees grew, so they figured that the land would grow good crops. And they needed to remove a lot of those trees, so they needed people who could come with an axe and get rid of those tree roots so they could plant stuff. And one of the major suspects in this case was someone who was called a grubber, who basically could swing an axe from any direction and get rid of these tree roots very quickly. And if you hear and look at what the murder scene was like, that axe was moving so quickly all over the place. There were even up until the point that the house was torn down in the 1950s, people who had lived there still lived in a house that actually had discarded axe, misguided axe swings in the door jamb. You could still see those axe marks years, decades after the crime.
And these people could swing an axe from either direction, but with both hands too.
Yes, and they could move with fierce force. This family almost didn't have a shot. You know, if somebody comes in the dead of night, the young woman she was in bed with her children, she was killed while she was still in bed, so they're believed that she was killed first. There was a real struggle that occurred between the younger Stelson Reed man, and he actually ended up missing three fingers in a really grisly fight.
Well, the axe wasn't the only weapon, because just to make sure, I guess the knife was also used.
Yes. The person who was doing this crime did not want this family to survive. They wanted to make sure everyone was dead. And that's why it really came down to this idea that it had to be a relative, is what a lot of the investigators came up with. You know, the elder Stelson Reed, the patriarch of the family, had a brother who used to live next door to them or on a neighboring farm in St. Clair County. He actually ended up moving three counties away because they had a bitter feud over an inheritance from a third brother in New York City. And the original Stelson Reeds had come to New York City and had a store in Greenwich Village, actually. And they thought maybe this bitter feud had somehow led to the elder Stelson Reed's brother wanting to kill his brother, because the elder Stelson Reed man was having feuds with everyone in town. He had become an alcoholic, and he was just fighting.
We only have 2 minutes left. Very quickly, there was another suspect who actually moved to Nebraska and changed his name.
That was one of the things I discovered, that I could never figure out whatever happened to him. And his last name was Bolts, and it was referred to that with a Z in all the newspaper articles. I could not find out for years whatever happened to him. Finally, I tracked him to Nebraska. He had slightly changed the spelling of his last name. He built a new life for himself. He got out of town after the murders. He had gotten some from the estate. He was a brother-in-law. He left. He was never seen again in St. Clair County.
So what does that tell you, changing the name? I mean, I can understand getting out of town, but
he no longer wanted to be in St. Clair County. It was very clear. He took his family, his large family, and he built a nice life for himself. He built a big sprawling farm, a homesteader in Nebraska, and he moved on with his life. One of the things, real quickly, in Germany, they lusted for land so bad, as did that man, and he finally got his dream.
Okay, we have 1 minute left. You've done all this research. You spent 10 years of your life working on this thing. Do you have any theories, after all the information you've put together, as to who the killer or killers might have been?
Well, I get that question a lot, and it's hard to point the finger in one direction because there are so many suspects, and you can make a case for any of them. The man from Nebraska, I do believe he hired someone. That's the best case I can come up with, that a hired hand possibly came in and killed the family for this crime. And one thing I want to advertise to people, I am doing a book signing in Fairview Heights, Barnes & Noble, on Saturday at 2 o'clock. So if anyone out there is interested in this case and wants to talk about it more with me, you're free to come on out Saturday at 2.
All right, in Fairview Heights at the Barnes & Noble. Nick Pister has been our guest. The book, once again, to remind you, the title is The Axe Murders of Saxtown, the unsolved crime that terrorized a town and shocked a nation. Saxtown was a German immigrant community in the Millstatt area near Belleville in the Metro East. Nick, congratulations on the book. We've talked about a lot of the things that happened during the course of this story, but I want to just tell people, it's still worth reading the book because there's so much in there that we haven't been able to discuss that paints a picture of what life in our community and our neighborhood was like 140 years ago. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Nick Pister. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about navigating the Affordable Care Act. We'll also meet Simeon Wright and hear his eyewitness account of the kidnapping of Emmett Till in 1955, the discovery of Till's body, the trial that followed, and its impact on race relations in our country. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.